still so dark because it's still so early, and the chipper little girlie at the front desk doesn't mind at all. These phony living rooms and fake plants are killing me. This bad coffee's filling me with equal parts joy and rage. Put my makeup on and crack in half, I choke back a laugh. Find the camera with the red light. Good morning, Tucson. The lights come on and so I smile wide and say, good morning, Tucson. I throw to you before I throw the rest away.
Hello again and welcome to another exciting episode of Panel Discussions. This is Russ Burlingame coming to you live from my glamorous Panel Discussion studios in sun-drenched Endicott, New York. Tonight we're going to be talking to Ron Mars. Ron is the writer of the upcoming Voodoo. It's part of DC's New 52 relaunch initiative. In addition to Voodoo, he writes Shinku for Image Comics, along with his co-creator Lee Motor. That's a creator-owned title. He also does a bunch of books for Top Cow, including Witchblade, Magdalena, and Artifacts. We're going to talk to Ron about writing for female characters, which is kind of a charged topic right now, as you may know. Also going to be talking to Fabian Nicieza today. Fabian has been around for a long while. He worked on the New Warriors and X-Men books in the 90s. Most recently, he worked on Red Robin, the series featuring Tim Drake for DC prior to the relaunch, and now he's going to be working with Legion Lost. Legion Lost is going to single out a handful of characters from the Legion of Superheroes and deal with them in the here and now as opposed to the 30th century. Both of these interviews are really exciting. Had a lot of fun talking to the guys. I want to get right to them. So we're going to have a few words from our good friends at Cloud City. And then on the other side of that, Fabian Nicieza.
Cloud City Comics and Toys in Shoppingtown Mall is your destination for the coolest toys, comics, and graphic novels like Walking Dead, Green Lantern, Thor, Captain America, and Kid Robot Vinyl Figures. Our super friendly staff will guide you through the world of awesome and get you in touch with your inner superhero. Because at Cloud City, you don't shop with us, you roll with us. Cloud City Comics and Toys, Shoppingtown Mall in DeWitt.
Today we have Fabian Nicieza joining us. Did I say that correctly, Fabian?
Said it perfectly. Thank you, Russell. The older I get, the longer I've been in the business, the more people start to get it right.
I used to butcher it when I was a kid, and now I found myself correcting other people on it because when I was interning at Wizard years ago, somebody lectured me about how, because you were doing X titles at the time, and of course Wizard and the X-Men, it's like chocolate and peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to make sure that we were absolutely on the right side of all the X creators when I was there.
That's good.
But
before I was writing X-Men, they didn't care how they pronounced my name. Before and after, that didn't make a difference.
In fairness, you know, it's a print magazine, so it's not quite as important. But it's always nice when the people on the phone are actually saying it correctly to you. So.
Yep.
But, Fabian is, like I said, has worked extensively on Marvel's X titles. Right now he's about to launch into Legion Lost, the first issue of which comes out on September 21st. Is that right?
No. It comes out this Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Yes. Sorry. I have two interviews this week, and one's the 14th,
cool.
The 21st. So, yeah.
Apparently, when you have 52 new number ones coming out, it's easy to get your shipping schedule mixed up.
Yeah, well, and that little thing that DC gave us the like teaser thing that has all the mm-hmm. dates on the back. I've been using that to keep track of things. But as I said, when I got evacuated from the house, that and my copy of Justice League International number one both got left in the bathroom.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
So, that's okay. The nice thing is, with Digital Day and Date, I was able to obtain a copy of Justice League, even though it was sold out, because Dan and I are old friends, and he does a running commentary column with me. It's been going on ever since Booster Gold number 5 or something.
Cool.
But, Legion Lost is one of those titles that I'm really excited about, not just because I'm interested in a new, different take on the Legion characters, who I've always been told are these great enduring characters but have never really grabbed me, but also because, frankly, I've always loved
anything of yours that I've read, and so the opportunity to kind of put those two things together and say, like, okay, now I can really give the Legion a chance with a writer I'm comfortable with. It's kind of a nice moment of serendipity.
I appreciate that, and I've gotten good feedback in that regard from a lot of people. That, you know, I know that Legion is a little bit of a tough sell to some people. I've been a fan since I was around 12, 13 years old, but that was more because of Dave Cockrum than it was because of the Legion itself. Then I got into the Legion more slowly. I got into Cockrum real quick. I bought the book back when he was drawing it because it just totally caught my eye on the newsstand. And this was the old days, 7-Eleven spinner racks we're talking about. Yeah. And then I kept getting it when Grell took over because I thought Grell was such a unique and interesting looking style. I mean, I know it was Neil Adams. I even knew back then that it was Neil Adams in terms of its approach, but he just had a very different visual sensibility for that book. So I enjoyed it then. And then I drifted back and forth. I'd pick it up a little bit and then not pick it up a while. And then I got caught back into it again when Pat Broderick was drawing it, not even before Giffen. Giffen was just doing the backups at that point. But I really liked Pat Broderick's work, so I started picking it up. And it reminded me of how much I liked the book and the characters and the tone. And it's a book that when it's done right, it really clicks on all cylinders. It juggles its cast really well. It's a very exciting, interesting book, but it's also a very difficult book to do right. So there are always time periods where you can go through stretches where it's not as strong as other times. But I stacked up some of the best stories of the Legion in the last 25 years against any other superhero book. I think that there's a lot of good stuff there. So when Bob Harris and Eddie Berganza and Brian Cunningham and Mike Martz all said that they wanted to have a get together with me, I knew something was happening, but I didn't know what at all. Still was writing Red Robin. And when they offered me the book, the first thing I said is, no, thank you, I'm not interested. It's too much hassle, too much continuity, too much worry, too much fan agita. And I just didn't, I don't have a lot of time for comics right now because I do a lot of non-comics work. And I want to enjoy what I do. And I wasn't sure that I'd be able to enjoy it. And then they said, take a sip of your beer, be quiet, and listen to us, and let us talk. So all they had to say, honestly, is Timberwolf and Wildfire and Dawnstar. And once they finished saying those three things, my mind just started drifting, and I was pretty much hooked, unfortunately. So we talked it all through. This was, you know, months and months and months ago. We talked it all through, and I realized what an exciting opportunity it was for me because I hadn't written a team book in a while, but I really enjoy doing them, and I think I'm pretty good at it, too, in terms of juggling the characters and the cast focus and the storylines and the plot lines. Team books really help me in terms of my pacing. I really am good at picking up the pace and coming up with really exciting cliffhangers when I'm juggling a team book. I find that in many ways easier than a solo book. So I just started thinking about all the opportunities and possibilities, And I'm being really honest and upfront in message boards and interviews and things like that. I feel like I've gotten to write the X-Men, and I've always wanted to write the Legion. And in Legion Lost, I'm almost getting to write both books at the same time. And that's not a negative in my mind. That's a real positive. And the direction of the book is going to make people really see and understand that as we go along in pretty interesting ways, I think.
Now, can you recap for us, because, again, I think most people have read all the solicitations for the new 52 titles, and they're really eagerly awaiting it. But for the people who don't know the basic premise of Legion Lost, what makes, you know, your Legion different from the Legion that's coming out from Paul Levitz?
Okay. The simple fact is that I have a Legion SEAL team that was trying to stop a terrorist attack on Earth in their time period, 1,000 years in the future, and they succeeded in stopping this terrorist, an alien named Alaster, from detonating a deadly plague in the future that was going to devastate humanity, because his sister was a college student, on Earth, and she died in one of the, Earth-first xenophobic human hate crimes that were going on in the Legion books in the last couple of years.
Uh-huh.
And it took him years to to find the way to try to get revenge for the death of his sister. So the Legion mission team is a field assignment team. Six characters went out, and ironically enough, seven characters come back in time. But in trying to stop him in the future, he, Alastor gets shunted through time, and they have to follow him. And they come back in time in pursuit of him, and time travel right now in the DC Universe is not and should not and hopefully will not always be an easy thing to do. I'm calling it the Flashpoint break wall, which is a bit of a haze in this period of time that is making things very difficult, both for anyone in the future to know exactly what happened in this time period, and for anyone from the future to come back in time. I would postulate that after 77 Ultimate Final Crises, Zero Hours, and now Flashpoints, that I think that there's been such a fracturing of time and multiverses that kind of travel from a physics standpoint shouldn't be, you know, snapping your fingers. It shouldn't be a cakewalk. So anyway, coming back in time is a risky thing. And you'll see how risky it is in the first three pages of the book when they first arrive. So the Legion field unit comes back in time to try to stop this guy from releasing this plague, and by the time they get here, they've already failed because it's already been released. Now they have to track this guy down, and they have to see if they can get back home before the damage is done too greatly, both in our present day and affecting the future. Things happen in the first issue, which will make that a very complicated proposition for the long-term, future of the characters, meaning they're stuck here. That's why they're called Legion Lost. And in becoming stuck here, their story becomes a little bit less how to get home, and their story becomes a little more what does home mean to us, and who are we going to be here? And that becomes the real crux, the real strong thematic element of the book, which is we are lost, but does that mean we have lost ourselves? Are we still Legion while we're here or not? And what does that mean to them? And what does that mean to the world, for that matter, especially when it's going to become a world that does not like them, does not trust them, and finds them responsible for a plague that is going to affect the whole DC universe, because this plague combines alien DNA with humans and can transform humans in a wild variety of ways. And it's affecting people, a lot of people. So there will be a species on Earth that will be called Hypersapiens, who are hybrid humans that have been transformed into alien, hybrid alien forms.
It's really interesting because, first of all, there's a lot of kind of information to absorb, and the idea that obviously you're not going to give away your whole first issue, so that's a lot of information to absorb, and there's a lot more coming in a couple of days. But
I don't want to give away the details of the issues, but I have no problem giving away the broad thematic parameters of the book.
Yeah.
That to me provides the foundation for what the stories are about. That doesn't mean I have to give away details of what the stories are about,
Yeah. It's also interesting to me, and again, this is coming from the perspective of somebody who, if you mention me to somebody who knows me, I'm the Booster Gold guy. And so the idea of time travel being much more kind of difficult and all this, the way you described it is actually, it really kind of harkens back to the way that they used to handle the Great Disaster to me. Thinking back to the Booster's original series in the 80s, he didn't have that thing that they've given him later on with 52 and stuff, where it's like he can predict and stop crimes because he's from the future. There was a premise kind of prior to the first, not even prior to the first crisis, but prior to probably Zero Hour, that people from the future didn't inherently know how every single story was going to end because they couldn't see clearly. And it sounds to me like by restoring that, you're giving a sense of consequences back to the Legion that they've been lacking a lot of the time when they come back recently.
Yeah, and I hope that it sticks. I have no control over what, 17 other editors do and 51 other creative teams do. Mm-hmm. I have to create a very strong binding parameter for my book that is logical, and I gotta hope that that logic permeates its way out to everyone else, because, you know, writers will, it's easy for a writer to take the easy way out when it comes to time travel and stuff if they want to do things of that nature. It's a lot harder to have to jump through the hoops that it takes to explain it within the parameters of something affecting the whole universe, you know? So that's really something that's got to be policed by editorial more than me. And if it gets contradicted or violated by things that go on in other books, I can only shrug my shoulders and just do what has to be done for the sake of my book and my characters.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's interesting because while a lot more of these rigid rules seem to be laid down for the New 52 kind of in general, they certainly, like, I've spoken to a lot of guys who are saying basically, you know, this is great because I get to play with DC's toys and they're basically treating it like a creator-owned book. They're letting me do, you know, what I think is artistically the best thing to do and not worry quite as much about the red tape as I used to. And is that something you're finding, or is working with something that has as much kind of bound up conflict as the Legion still kind of
there's no continuity issues at all. I mean, I don't have to worry about Legion continuity, really. I gotta worry about my seven characters continuity, and that's it. I'm set in the present day, so it doesn't make a difference to me what's happening in the main Legion of Superheroes book. They have no effect on each other at all. And quite frankly, never will, unless we plan on rescuing the characters and bringing them home, you know? I'm in my own little corner of the universe, but that's kind of where I have to be, because my storyline unfolds kind of slowly. This is not something that can sweep the world in 2 months. Otherwise, it has no real dramatic build, and it has no real impetus to affect other titles. So I'm starting in the Midwest. My first six issues are almost completely set in Minnesota and Wisconsin, which is where Alastor first shows up, and showing hints that it's spreading out from there. And eventually, inevitably, we've already talked about how we are going to have to come in contact with other characters. We are going to have, we are going to have ramifications that go out of Legion Lost into other books, because if this is creating a new species on Earth, it's something that should be reflected by things that are happening in other titles. And not the least of which, I still have the Superman, maybe even Superboy connection that I have to contend with. And we plan to do that too, just not immediately. There's a very viable reason why they don't go to find Superman and ask for his help, and that gets explained really quickly in like the second issue. So we're going to get to all of that, and that's when we'll start to see more ties with the main DC universe. But for now, I guess it does feel like a creator-owned book in that we are kind of on our own. Which is a good place to be when you're starting out, because it really forces you to focus solely on your characters and try to really make them work in the beginning of the book. And that's great, because it sets the entire foundation for whatever you're going to do in the future.
And is it tough working with characters who, because in my experience, the Legion fans, because they are few and rabid, They remind me a lot of, like, the Captain Marvel fans. And it's this thing of, they have a very specific vision of these characters. And if you don't adhere to what they've got in their head, then you're just the worst person in the history of the world. And is it kind of difficult working within a framework where you know that, like, you've got to please everybody all the time, or else you're going to hear about it?
Nah, I don't care. Nah, it doesn't make a difference to me. I've already tasted Legion fans, you know, a little bit through message board interaction on a regular basis on several message boards, and they're like any other fans. There's some that are going to be jerks, and there are the vast majority that are totally cool. Some of them might be into the minutiae a bit, but, you know, my attitude about the whole thing is, I've been reading the Legion since 1972, which is probably longer than most of them have. And I'm also responsible for writing the book. So I've been a long-time reader, and now I'm a writer. And I have to make the decisions that I think are right for the book, and I've been doing this long enough that to say that I have a certain level of confidence about what needs to be done to write a comic book is a bit of an understatement. So I took over for X-Men after 17 years of Chris Claremont, and if I could survive that, I think I could pretty much survive anything. So it doesn't worry me in the least. I know I'm going to get some things wrong. I know they're going to get some things wrong in terms of how they interpret certain things in the book. That's fine. That's what it's all for. At the end of the day, you got the choice. Put your money down, buy the book, read the book, enjoy the book, or not. Either way, your choice. You know, I've been doing this too long to worry that much about it.
And the nice thing, too, is you know, when you say, well, you know, I'm going to get something wrong, with the new universe, it's like, well, if you get something wrong, you can just say, well, that's how it is now, and move on.
Yeah, I want to try to avoid that if possible, because that's kind of lazy writing to me, but I guarantee you that I will fall back on that if I make a mistake. So once I find out I did something wrong, I can just go, oh, yeah, no, it's because it's a new universe. There you go.
Yeah. And it's really ironic because from what I understand, and admittedly I haven't paid as much attention to the main Legion of Superheroes book as I have to Legion Lost, the Legion historically has this history of getting juggled after every big crossover, especially the ones that involve time travel. And this
No, go ahead, keep going.
I was just going to say, this time it seems as though, for the most part, the Legion have escaped unscathed and everybody else is getting juggled.
Yeah, historically speaking, crises on DC Earth have not been kind to The Flash, the Justice Society of America, or the Legion of Superheroes. Those three would fight it out for the title of who gets screwed the most. But I don't think that in this particular instance it's having that level of an effect on us. I mean, I've read the first several of Paul's scripts, and I know my book also. I was very confused, frankly, as a reader in the last few years about what age these characters were supposed to be anyway. That when we initially talked about the start of this book and the start of the new, you know, 52 universe, what it meant for the characters in terms of their status quo and their position, and we determined that pretty much everything that happened to them has happened to them, okay? We just wanted them to be a little younger. I especially wanted them to be a little younger because, like I said, I didn't know how old they were supposed to be. When Geoff Johns brought them back into action and all that, I really didn't know if these guys were supposed to be in their early 20s or if they were in their early 30s. Were they Superman's age or were they still college age, you know? I couldn't tell. Nothing clearly indicated to me what they were. And I talked to the editors about that. And we decided that we were comfortable with making them a little younger than they might have appeared recently, keeping them much more in line to what the original heyday of the Legion in the 70s and 80s was all about. They're all roughly between the ages of like 18 and 23. They've all been Legionnaires for X number of years, some for one or two, some for three or four, depending on who they are. And then hit the ground running from there. I don't have to worry about, about any changes in their origin stories. I don't have to worry about any changes in the events that have happened to them. Like you said, there's a beauty in the Legion, and they've been screwed over so many times. They've had so many reboots from so many different Earths that I got the best of both worlds, because I get to say that I am both the original Legion, you know, that started from the 50s, 60s, 70s into the 80s, but I also have touches of some of the reboot Legions too, because I got Gates in the book as well, you know? So I get to cheat a little bit if I want to.
And, you know, I think that, and again, I'm not a big Legion guy, and I know that some of the longer running Legion fans had problems with some of the stuff that he did, but I think that was kind of the beauty of what Geoff was able to craft in Action Comics and Legion of Three Worlds, is that he restored, you know, the classic status quo without eradicating everything that came after it. And I feel like that's a lot of what they're trying to do across the board with this relaunch. And
I think they are. And I think they'll be successful or not successful on a case-by-case basis rather than a line basis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It'll all depend on how the writers and the editors approach the individual books themselves rather than some sort of a line-wide problem or even line-wide success for that matter. I've been fortunate enough that I got to read almost all those 52 issue number ones weeks ago. They were provided to us if we wanted to read them, and I've read a lot of them. I haven't read all 52, I'm sorry. I've read about like 35 or 40 of them. But it's like any comic book line by any publisher. I'm almost 50 years old. I've been reading a long, long time. I'm going to like some things. I'm not going to like some things as much. But for the most part, I did not see a single writer who blatantly tried to play God with their character and change at a whim or arbitrarily change whatever it was that was the foundation of what this character was all about. I think they're being very respectful of the fact that these characters do have a history. Even in the context of this new 52, they have a history, because with a lot of them, we're hitting the ground running, and they are who they are already, you know?
Right.
So I think that a lot of readers who are worried about the sky falling are going to be pleasantly surprised, or some of those people who feel that way sometimes are unpleasantly surprised because they expect and want the worst so that they have something to complain about. I think they've done a good job overall. Most of the writers and editors have done a really good job of attending to understanding who the characters are. And I think that it also feels a lot fresher. A lot of the books feel a lot fresher, a lot more energetic, a lot more vibrant. We have been talked to extensively about making these books accessible to all readers. This is not intended to just be for the 44-year-old reader who's been reading for 24, 30 years. You know, this is meant to be something that anyone can pick up, whether they're 12 years old or whether they're 62. They can pick this up and they can understand who these characters are. And that harkens back to the way I was raised, both reading comics and in the industry when I first became a part of it in 1985, which was a real, real strong adherence to the notion that any issue could be somebody's first issue. And that becomes really passe and really coy when you're catering solely to a shrinking minority of readers who have been reading forever, and dismiss that kind of storytelling. But it's invaluable when you're trying to expand your readership and you're trying to build a larger publishing base. And we're doing that. I know I'm doing that in my book. I've had the luxury of time on my book because we're in really good shape on our schedule, where I've gotten to go back and rewrite entire scripts after the book was penciled because we decided we wanted to try a couple different things, and I had the time to do that. You know, issue number two went through like three revisions, and most of those were me and Brian Cunningham, my editor, just talking it out and trying to get to the right point, the right balance of information being disseminated, emotion being disseminated, and letting the art tell the story, to a little bit of everything. And it felt really good because it almost felt like I was working on New Warriors number three, you know, or number two. It felt like the kinds of discussions we had back in the day, as it were, to try to make sure that the books were hitting every potential audience member that it could possibly hit, instead of what I feel has frankly become in the last 10 years, which is a real coy boys club who think they're cooler than everyone else, and that's what the majority of the stories were being written for and sold to.
It's fascinating for me, and I grant you that, like, when I heard about this, I thought it was an exciting idea, and I've gone in pretty open-minded to it, but it's interesting for me as a longtime reader and as primarily a DC guy, how easily I've slipped into the mentality of these just being first issues. And because, you know, I picked up two or three books, and the first two or three, you have a hard time divorcing yourself of it. But I feel like very quickly I was able to kind of slip into this mindset, and now everyone I open, you know, because I've for the sake of reviews, I've read all 14 of the ones that are out now, and to me it's like I've had such an easier time than I expected to divorcing myself from most of the past history, and you know, every now and again you have something that you really like that you find out doesn't exist anymore, or something that you were hoping to happen that hasn't hit yet, and that's when you start to fall back and be like, oh, but what about this? But for the most part, I've been really impressed by the ability of the writers to craft a universe where it credibly feels like a first issue in every one of these books.
Yeah, and that's good. I think that's good. I think it's important. I totally understand fans who get upset about these changes. I certainly understand the fans who get upset by the numbering changes. I mean, I have every issue of Superman in Action Comics from, like, I got every issue of Superman from, like, number 98 all the way up to present day. So when the number ceases and starts over again, I feel kind of like the run of Superman that I put together
for
50 years old is kind of washed out. But that's the collector in me. The reader in me thinks very differently, which is not a single story that I ever read doesn't exist. That's ridiculous. They exist exactly where they've always existed in the comics I read, you know?
Yeah.
Most of mine happen to be in my basement on shelves, you know? So they're still there. They never went away. I mean, different elements of the current storyline may change, but it doesn't mitigate or violate anything you ever read before when you were younger, you know? So I think that these things need to be refreshed every once in a while, and historically they always have been refreshed. Marvel and DC have always refreshed their properties. I mean, DC's done it in different ways than Marvel has, but at this point, both companies have done this long enough that I don't think readers should be surprised when it happens. You don't have to like it. You're more than welcome to not try it. That's your choice. But you also have to understand that DC Comics is a publishing business, and that means they have to sell comics and make money in order to be a business. And they weren't doing enough of that, and they decided they needed to try to do something to sell more comics. And this was what they decided to do. And you can question whether that's the right choice or not before it comes out. You can question whether it's the right choice or not as it comes out. And you can question whether it was the right choice or not 5 years from now, you know? But they're in charge of having to make those decisions, and they're not easy decisions to make. I think it's kind of cool. The words I used to the guys when we had that first dinner months ago was, you guys got balls of brass to do this. and I think it's really, really cool that you're doing it. And it could be a disaster. It could be incredible. Or probably it'll be somewhere in between, you know? And so far, so good, though. The numbers are phenomenal. The interest level is higher than it's been for DC or for any comics in general, quite frankly, in a very long time. I mean, in an age where you need to get publicity for a comic book by either killing a character off or having a character become a different race, and then have to explain that that character is actually part of an alternate timeline, it's not really the character that they thought it was, like Marvel just did with Spider-Man. I mean, it's all a shell game. And you know, and I don't even say that as a negative thing. It's all a shell game. These things have been going on for 70 years, 50 years. You got to do stuff once in a while to mix it up a bit, you know? You can't eat chicken salad every single day for lunch. Once in a while, you got to try the tuna.
I'll get back to Legion after I make this observation, but I think it's interesting to note how much less the fans are willing to embrace change than creators, because the big one that has hit in the last week, because Dan DiDio went public with this, you know, less than 24 hours before Justice League International hit, is this notion that, you know, the old Max Lord JLA never happened, and that, you know, Ted Kord never existed. And all the old Justice League International fans were up in arms. Meanwhile, Mark DeMatteis was like, have they taken away all my comics and burned them?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because, and especially after, you know, say what you want to say about the way that some of those characters have been treated for the last few years and some of the et cetera, but, I mean, DC has done those nice prestige format hardcovers for like 50 issues of that run, and then gave them the chance to do that last send-off with Kevin McGuire on art. And you sit here and go, like, well, you know, the fans can get upset, but at the same time, like, you've been given as much of this content as humanly possible so that in the best possible formats. And I kind of feel like it's always fascinating to see people get hypered up into a frenzy over, you know, what ultimately is supposed to be enjoyable.
it's an emotional thing versus a logic thing. And I think that the creators actually approach it a little less emotionally, oddly enough, because they're on the inside looking out and the fans are on the outside looking in. So, you know, we're privy to the decision making or the discussion behind the decision making. We're uh-huh. privy to the creative opportunities it opens up rather than those that it seals off. And it's what we do for a living. It's what we get paid to do. The fans don't get paid to read. They got to pay to read. And that's a different vested interest also. And I get it. I totally get it. I mean, I was buying my own comics for, you know, before I started working at Marvel, I was buying my own comics for 30 years, but 25 years. But after I started working at Marvel, I got everything for free for a long, long time. And in the last 10 years or so, 15 years or so, since I left the claim, I wasn't getting comics for free anymore from anybody, so I had to buy my own. And mm-hmm. and it really made me wake up and start to look at what I was buying and why I was buying it and things like that. I mean, and I stopped buying certain books that I would have thought I would keep buying forever because I wasn't enjoying them or I didn't think they were treating me right as a reader. So I totally understand that thinking. I totally get that mentality. But when I'm writing a book, I'm thinking about it very differently. I totally get the yin yang of that. I understand it. My only frustration is when some fans aren't able to meet in the middle. It's mm-hmm. almost Republicans and Democrats sometimes. They're not able to meet in the middle and understand each of their points of view. But like I said, those are the minority of fans, you know, and every book has them, every creator has them. It's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. You know, but I agree with, like I said, I said the same thing Mark Tamada said, and we just said it in different ways.
Yeah,
nobody
exactly.
Took comics away from me. I still got all my old comics. I can go look at them anytime I want.
And like I said, getting back to the Legion as we kind of try to wrap up here, because I don't want to keep you too late in the middle of the night. But with once again time travel being more or less verboten, and you know, this series being one of those things that seems from the premise like it ought to be finite. You know, when you have characters that are lost, ideally, eventually the resolution is that they are found. How do you kind of pace out a story like that so that, you know, if it lasts 1 year or if it lasts 7 years, you're still, you know, you're not stretching thin?
It's a difficult question to answer in that for the last 15 years or so in this industry, every single comic for the most part that's been published has been considered a limited series whose length has yet to be determined, mm-hmm. as I call it. Because, you know, with the industry being where it is, you never really know for sure how long your books are going to last. You could be writing a book that you think is doing real solid, and they pull the rug out from under you and decide to go in a different publishing direction, like happened with Robin, and even just happened to me again with Red Robin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no planning for 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road as anything other than basic landmarks that you're looking for as you're driving down the road. You know, they're guideposts or up ahead. So I could easily tell you what I think where we will be with Legion Lost with issue 25 and with issue 50, but I'm not necessarily planning for that the way I might have back in the old days when I was writing, you know, New Warriors or X-Men or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I came to a really, really quick understanding of what this book was about and why it was called Legion Lost. And I'm enjoying the fan speculation being exactly what your question was. Everyone is focusing on the word lost as a geographic definition, and I am not focusing on that at all. Them being lost has absolutely nothing to do with them being trapped in time necessarily, in so much it has to do with if they are trapped in time and if they are responsible for having released a pathogen into the planet that is affecting thousands of people for the negative for the most part, then how do you find yourself again? It's not about other people finding them. It's really about them finding themselves and finding their way in this world. And once you look at it from that perspective, then there is no finite need. There's no need to worry about finite time periods. There's no need to worry about an end to their story because their story is endless. And as a result, the opportunities for stories with these characters here in our time are also endless.
Thanks very much to Fabian for joining us this week. As I said, I'm really excited about talking to Ron again. We talked not only about voodoo specifically and about writing for female characters more generally, but we talked about the kind of gender and sexuality issues that are facing DC and the industry at large right now. We talked a little bit about digital comics and what digital means for piracy, if anything. Really, we kind of bounced all over the place, but I thought it was a really worthwhile conversation. You can see bits and pieces of it spotlighted at comicbook.com and a couple of interviews that Ron and I have done, but the whole thing is here exclusively on panel discussions. So, without further ado, Mr. Ron Mars.
All right, we're back. I've got Ron Mars with me right now. Ron is the writer of many things, including the fantastic Shinku and Witchblade and Artifacts for Top Cow, although Witchblade not for much longer. And he's got, starting on Wednesday, Voodoo for DC's New 52 initiative lined up. We're doing our best to talk to a handful of the people who have kind of lower on the radar New 52 titles on the show. We talked to Fabian about Legion Lost in the same episode. In the last few weeks, we've talked to Jeff Lemire about Frankenstein. We talked to Kyle Higgins about Deathstroke and Josh Fialkov about I, Vampire. So I wanted to talk to you. I mean, and one of the things that I try to keep consistent through all that is these are all books that really look appealing to me, but that aren't, you know, obviously it's harder when DC has a new Batman and a new Superman book to promote. It's hard for everybody to get equal time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a two-edged sword because you know that the majority of the eyes are going to be on the things that you expect, Batman and Superman and Green Lantern. So you're fighting an uphill battle in terms of readership, but the nice thing about it is that you're not too tied into expectations and the world that those characters already inhabit. There's a lot of baggage that comes with working on the bigger characters, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing about Voodoo is that we're really starting from square one. We're starting from what is really her first appearance in the DCU, and we're kind of building from scratch. So the baggage that you might have with some other characters is not something that we have to worry about. We can kind of play it fast and loose.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be more or less the prevailing philosophy across the line in terms of the Wildstorm characters that are being brought into the DC universe. And obviously, we haven't seen everything yet, and books like Grifter, you know, we've seen one issue that was kind of slow-paced in terms of revealing a whole lot of information. But it certainly seems like the strategy is that the less people know about these characters, the more important it is to start from ground zero.
Well, yeah, I think we're really treating them as very much a fresh start. And because, certainly in the case of Voodoo, because this is her introduction to the DCU, and this is her introduction to the readers, it's very much a ground floor read, with a sense of, you know, we're trying to preserve a sense of mystery to it and peel back the layers of her character as we go. But I wanted to make sure that if you pick up Voodoo Number One, you've got at least a sense of where the book is headed, who she is, and what her goals and motivations are. And, you know, obviously we try to wrap all that up in 20 pages and then get the hook in your mouth to bring you back for the next issue.
Now, one thing that I'll say right off the top of my head, because I honestly, I was never a huge Wildstorm guy when I was younger, and so I had to kind of go and refresh myself a little bit with the internet. She's much less superheroic so far in all these covers than you see, like, you know, her stock photo from the Wildstorm days. Is that something that's just part of the sensibility in terms of how you're dealing with her character?
Well, she's not a superhero. She's not even a good guy in a lot of ways. Because we were very much starting from a blank slate in terms of her past and her past within the DCU, we could kind of pick and choose what we wanted from her Wildstorm iteration, figure out what we thought worked, kind of ignore the parts that we didn't think fit as well into the DCU. So really what we've ended up with is a book that's much more of an espionage book set in a superhero universe rather than a straight superhero book.
Now, one of the things that's really interesting, certainly all the solicitations and promotion that we've seen so far is playing up the alien aspects of her character. And that seems to be, you know, in the DC universe, that seems to be a big thing. Obviously, they're dealing with that issue in Superman in terms of people's general fear of aliens. But, you know, Dan had told me a while back that Martian Manhunter wouldn't have been welcome in the Justice League International because there's an absolutely no aliens policy by the UN. Without, you know, spoiling too much of anybody else's kind of thing, is there a general take in the DC universe that aliens are much scarier than they were, you know, 6 months ago?
You know, I don't know if I would deem it as much scarier, but they're certainly not as trusted as they were 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's been done kind of brings back the alien quality to the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's obviously one of the dangers that that exists when you're dealing with, you know, a continuity-driven universe that's gone on for 50 years. There's not a lot of stones unturned. There's not a lot that's new and different. You know, aliens attack every other week, right?
Yeah.
Being able to kind of reset the clock on the DC universe allows everybody to make the aliens a little scarier, a little more unknown, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it just gives you more tools in your storytelling toolbox. Though, for all intents and purposes, Voodoo looks just like one of us, for the most part. But there's obviously some alien heritage going on, and that's one of the things that we'll explore as we get deeper into the series is, you know, how is she an alien hybrid? And, okay, specifically, what sort of alien hybrid is she? And some of these are things that she knows, and we'll slowly bring the readers into it. And some are things that she doesn't even know.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good kind of starting point, again, without kind of delving too much into your entire first issue. What does she know at the start of this issue? Because obviously, to varying degrees, to start out with certain characters, you hit the ground running, and certain other characters, like, you know, once again, I'll use Grifter as an example, just because it's fresh on my mind. He had no idea what was going on to him on page one.
Voodoo is really pretty certain of what she's doing in the first issue. She has a mission. She knows what she's doing. And truthfully, I don't think Voodoo speaks her first line in the book until page 9 or 10.
Hmm.
So first half of the book is very much looking at her from another perspective, from the perspective of a couple of government agents that are following her, that are surveilling her. So she knows exactly what she's doing, but we keep a bit of mystery to her, at least for the first bit of the book, and then we reveal some of the layers as we go through the issue, and then hopefully kind of surprise everybody when we get to the end of it.
It's funny, because when you say that it reminds me of the second issue of Shinku, where, by and large, it was mostly action, and the only people who were doing any talking was everybody else for the first chunk of the issue. And obviously, you and I talked about at the time the kind of importance of what Lee brought to the table in terms of visual storytelling. How important is it to have a talented artist on board when you're dealing with a character who doesn't speak for half the first issue, and then when she does, she might be lying because it's an espionage book?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, anytime you're doing a book, particularly a monthly book where you're telling an ongoing story, you play to the artist's strengths. You figure out what the artist does well and maybe what the artist doesn't do as well, and you write the book to take advantage of those skills. So, you know, one of the things that I was really taken by in Sammy Bosser's work is that he's really good at, you know, for lack of a better term, we call acting. He's really good at facial expressions and body language and the kind of stuff that that communicates visually, not necessarily through text. So the fact that he can pull all that stuff off is a real boon for me, because I can let the visuals carry a certain amount of the storytelling, and I can just kind of get the hell out of the way. That's actually the best scenario for a writer, period, because you can just, literally the picture is worth 1,000 words, so you don't have to do anything. And I think I think things come off more elegantly that way if you're letting the visual storytelling do its job.
Hold on just a second. Sorry, I'm getting over bronchitis, so every so often I have to pause and cough, and I'm trying not to do into a microphone. But one thing that I'll ask you, just because, you know, it's everywhere today, and certainly your book hasn't been dragged into the mud puddle yet, but it probably will next week.
Oh, yes, it has, and it certainly will.
Oh, has it? I haven't paid that much attention, I guess, in the last 6 hours, because Tuesday or Wednesday, Thursday are pretty busy on my day job. But this whole thing with it started with like the gender crunching article, which of course then turned out to be widely inaccurate, but the themes of it, and you know, this idea of the way women are depicted by comics in general, and DC's kind of getting kind of unfairly targeted by virtue of the fact that the New 52 is in the news. How tough is it? I mean, because you, like I said, you're a guy who does a lot of strong female characters, usually wouldn't have to wrestle with this kind of thing. But not only are you in the thick of the New 52, but your character is an exotic dancer.
Yeah, how about that? you know, it's part and parcel of what goes on with this. And anytime you do a large initiative that gets a lot of press, you know, the pendulum always swings back and forth, and everybody's excited about it at first, and then after a few weeks, well, you know, geez, it's not cool to be excited about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody has to start, you know, picking at scamps and taking pot shots, whether it's valid or not. And I'm not saying whether it's valid in this case or not, because frankly, I haven't read the issues that everybody's, you know, got their niggers in a twist about. You know, I think that the thing that gets under my skin is that if there's an issue or a title that doesn't seem to portray women in a positive light, or minorities in a positive light, or lesbians or gays in a positive light for an issue, everybody immediately loses their mind and wants to paint the whole thing with a broad brush. And I am, you know, I think comics have to do a better job in the depiction of women. I think comics have to do a better job in the hiring of women. But I'm not willing to look at two books that came out in the same week and lose my mind over it because somebody didn't like it or somebody got their nose out of joint in terms of the way that certain characters were portrayed. I think it's very easy to stand back and throw rocks because, you know, anytime this kind of stuff comes up, it's not really a dialogue. It's a discussion of monologues. You know, it's a series of monologues where the, you know, the parties involved say what they want to say, arrange their evidence in whatever way best supports their argument, and ignore everything else. You know, it's just unfortunate that that I think people come to this kind of argument or even this kind of discussion with a chip on their shoulder. You know, and I'm not specifically talking about the Catwoman and Starfire thing. This is really a general kind of approach, is that everybody has an axe to grind. And I think specifically in comics, I think more so than any other media that I'm at least familiar with, people get really bent out of shape if a book isn't exactly what they want it to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's if, you know, if I'm trying to think of, you know, somebody, some musical artist that I could really give a shit about, you know, if Celine Dion or, you know, Justin Bieber puts out an album, well, I ignore it completely. It doesn't interest me whatsoever. And, you know, I don't rail about, well, why didn't Justin Bieber do an album that I want just the way I like it? I just don't worry about it. But it seems like in comics, because these are shared universes and the audience has a very, you know, a very tight relationship with the characters, it seems like that's a recurring theme. You know, it's not that we get into a position of, well, you know, that book doesn't really interest me, so I'm not going to bother with it. It's, why isn't that book what I want it to be? And, you know, on the one hand, you admire the passion and you love the passion in the readership, but, you know, on the other side of the coin, you really want people to kind of dial it back and not get so crazy about stuff, particularly after one issue.
Mm-hmm. Or before one issue.
Well, yeah, or before one issue. I mean, certainly, you know, certainly Voodoo has kind of been dragged into this discussion of the depiction of women, even though the book's not out yet. And you know, specifically the person that was lumping Voodoo in with Catwoman and the Starfire scene, you know, was lumping Voodoo in, and I just, you know, thought, well, this is kind of silly. You haven't even read the book.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think is fascinating about it is, with a character like Voodoo, it never would have been a concern if this conversation wasn't going on for unrelated things. Because, in fiction, you know, you have people who live in dark places. And so it's not uncommon to have somebody who is an exotic dancer or a drug dealer or whatever, you know, take your pick of things that you would rather not be but that people are.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, again, everybody brings baggage to the discussion, and everybody, to a certain extent, has an axe to grind in one form or another. And that's fine. Everybody comes to whatever their entertainment is or whatever they're consuming with some kind of preconceived notion.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get around that. My approach to it is, you know what? If you don't like it, that's cool. And if you're offended by it, that's fine. Tell people you're offended by it. But at least read it first.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you that you know, Justin Bieber's album sucks, or that the Catwoman issue was terrible, because frankly, I didn't listen to one and I didn't read the other. So I have no basis to form an opinion.
Yeah.
I'm happy to tell you what I think after I've actually sampled whatever we're talking about. But, you know, again, it gets back to simply painting with a broad brush, because somebody judged Voodoo by looking at one black and white page with no dialogue on it.
I think that was the fascinating.
That's not judging a story. That's judging a picture.
You can judge whether
you like the picture or not, but don't presume that you know what the story is, because frankly, maybe there's a reason she's a stripper. Maybe the story goes to a place that you don't think it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you don't want to read a story about someone who is performing as a stripper, that's okay. That's absolutely everybody's right. But don't decide that you know what it is without even bothering to look at it.
It's interesting to me because this issue, and again, I really was kind of oblivious to everything today. I didn't hear Voodoo in the discussion, but previously, like, Voodoo had been kind of in this discussion from the very get-go because the very first image that we saw was her on all fours. But once the actual, like, colored and lettered preview pages got out there, people kind of seemed to, I mean, and again, you might have a different perspective being the writer because you're married to this book, but like, to me as an outsider, people seemed to kind of shut up because it, you know, that was like the actual preview pages that you saw that DC released with the colors and letters really were not offensive. And so,
well, you know, I don't think there's a, you know, I know, let me see, three or four people that have read the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Me, the editor, the assistant editor, and, you know, people up the chain at DC, and my wife. So the only person that I know that read the book that's a woman is a lady I'm married to. So I don't presume that she has a completely unbiased view of the issue, but I also know full well that if she was offended or pissed off in some way, she'd certainly let me know.
Yeah.
So, you know, when my comp showed up and I handed her the issue the other day, I said, tell me what you think. And, you know, the only thing she said is, that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, her taste isn't everybody's taste.
Right.
But, you know, she wasn't offended. She wasn't like, well, what the hell did you do, you know, writing a book set in a strip club? But, you know, she's read all 20 pages, so she might have a better idea of what that is.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to sidetrack this and have this whole conversation be about that, but I felt like because it's going on today, it was something I had to kind of address.
Well, ultimately, you know, ultimately people are going to think what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And there will certainly be people who have an opinion who never even opened the book. That's just the way this works. You know that going into it. I'm more concerned with the opinion of the people that actually read it and see what they get out of it than I am with people who just want to hold it up as a scalp in their crusade.
Yeah. It'll be interesting.
And look, you know, it's not like I said, you know, hey, give me a book so I can, you know, that's the first issue in a strip club.
Yeah.
The fact that she was a stripper was a touchstone in her wildstorm past. Nobody said you have to keep that. You have to make that part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I decided that I thought that would be an interesting place to start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason she's a stripper, and there's a reason she's in that particular club, but you're going to kind of have to read it to find out. And it's not because she likes taking her clothes off. So, you know, and certainly, look, I'm not naive either. I know that there's a certain amount of provocative material that is going to get people talking about the book.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't put it in there simply because it's provocative material. It's part of the story. It's part and parcel of the story. But, you know, we don't have the benefit of Superman or Batman in the first issue. When they offered me the book, they told me it was an edge book, and I said, what does that mean? How far can I go?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we'll let you know when to stop. and they haven't said stop yet. So it's not in there because, let's get some, 35-year-old guys who haven't been on a date in 15 years to pick up this book. It's because it's an edgy story, it's a spy story, and it's a sexy story.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I think it is. Other people might not find it to be any of those things. And that's fine, too. But really, when I've been writing these issues, anytime you've gotten to something that I thought was, let's make sure that this is within bounds of the kind of storytelling we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I ask myself is, would I see this in a James Bond movie?
Mm-hmm.
And if the main character was a male, would anybody get bent out of shape about it?
Right.
And I haven't written anything in any of these books where the answer came back that, you're just doing it because it's a woman.
Right. Now, one thing, changing gears kind of wildly, but one thing that is interesting about books like the ones I'm talking about, the Deathstrokes and I Vampires and Voodoos of the world, that you kind of assume when you see a title like that you know how it's going to sell. The upside to the New 52 is that hasn't held true. Every book is selling out. And do you think that this will be one of those situations where, quality will out, at least for a little while, and that books will, because, even if you lose 30-40% of readership or whatever going from issue one to issue two, then you have a much bigger base to start with. And as long as the book is good and most of the people who try it this month like it, how much do you think the relaunch is going to help some of these books that are, not marquee characters?
Oh, it's a huge factor in terms of getting eyes on the books.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously and I think that the relaunch has been more wildly successful than anybody really predicted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great to see that this stuff is being embraced by the audience and not just the, as far as I can tell, this is all,
right,
anecdotal from, people on Twitter and talking to people at the Baltimore convention and just, getting feedback from comic shops. It seems like, yes, the existing audience is checking the stuff out, but from what I can tell, some lapsed readers are coming back, some
mm-hmm.
new readers are coming in. So it's, I think it's a mix of a lot of different readerships. Now, you're going to get eyes on the material, and the proof is in whether they come back for the next bunch of issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the real positive is that when you do something like this, when you do a book that's not a mainstream superhero title, an icon type,
right,
of person, you're fighting an uphill battle for readers all the time. So the relaunch is providing a platform for everybody to get their books looked at, which is a very unusual occurrence for this to happen on such a widespread level.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, not every book is going to be great. Not every book is going to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
But the level of excitement for people who are trying some or even all of the titles is pretty cool. Attrition from issue one down, that's just the way comics works.
Mm-hmm.
Every book loses sales between issue one and issue two, and issue two and issue three, and issue three and issue four. That's just the way things trend, except in very rare instances.
Right.
And I would expect these will be very much the same. But this kind of feels like an opportunity for books that might not reach an audience to get in front of some people and maybe turn some heads. And I one of the things I'm really excited about with the relaunch, and this isn't to be a DC cheerleader because I'm doing all the books, this is me as a guy who works in the industry and me as a comic fan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's awesome that there's a pretty wide range of genres beyond the superheroes in this relaunch. You know, there are war books, there are villain books, there are espionage books and horror books. You know, compared to what you usually get in comics for genre diversity, this is a pretty big deal for me, because I'm always the guy up on a soapbox saying we need to do more different kinds of comics to attract different kinds of readers. So the fact that you have an espionage book like Voodoo and a war book like Blackhawks or Men of War and a Western and some straight up horror books, to me is a real step forward. And hopefully the audience will hold on to those books. And we know they're going to read Batman and Superman and Action. And Justice League, that's awesome. Everybody loves those kind of books. That's what we all grew up on, and that's in large part why all of us are doing this professionally, is because we fell in love with those kind of books as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that there's a bunch more out there with this 52 launch is, to me, really tremendous.
Yeah. And then one other thing that kind of ties to the relaunch, you're a guy who's been really vocal on Twitter and in, I don't know if I've seen it in interviews, but certainly on Twitter and on message board kind of situations about the pervasive effect of piracy on comics. And what do you think is the effect, if at all, of digital day and date on those kinds of issues?
Man, if I could give you an answer that I knew was right, I wouldn't have to write topics. I could, just watch the checks roll in. it's certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, how much of an effect it's going to have, I really don't know. It's a much larger question because you have to start, dealing with, well, what's the right price point? And, how do we bundle these things and what's the right model? We as an industry are just taking the first baby steps towards what I think is really a digital future in terms of single issue content.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, the stuff that you always heard from the guys who would apologize away their downloading was that, I can't get this on the day it comes out. I have to, I have to read an illegal download because of, X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no comic shop nearby. I live in a foreign country. I don't have the money. I'm left-handed. Mm-hmm. Whatever bullshit reason that anybody wanted to give you to excuse their theft of intellectual property, one of the primary ones was, there isn't a better option, so I have to do this.
Right.
Well, now that option's there. So quit your whining, I lost my job and I have to keep up with my comics and they're expensive and, shut up, grow up, pay for what you read. Now you can do that. You can do that the day these books hit the stands. That option is there, and that option is just going to grow. I think this was really the first fairly large rock to create a big ripple in the
mm-hmm.
And I think more and more content is going to go day and date. It's obviously a balancing act because the lifeblood of the industry in many ways is still the direct market. So that's what the balancing act is. That's why the price points are what they are. That's why it took this long to get to same day digital. We can't burn down the direct market in order to simply feed the digital outlets. It's a balancing act. Comics need both of them. And I give DC credit for at least attempting to figure out a way to get this process started. You know, ultimately how this affects piracy, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of people just are going to do it because they don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, whatever reason that they'll tell you to make themselves feel better about it, ultimately there's a group of people who just aren't going to pay for it because they feel like, well, if it's free, why should I pay for it?
It's a bizarre thing.
To, well, somebody actually owns this and somebody's trying to make a living off of doing this, so I should support them in that if I want this material. Okay, that's something, you know, if you're that self-centered that you can't grasp that, whether the book is available same day or not, it's really not an issue for you. You know, if you're selfish enough that, well, I just want it, whether it's available the same day or 2 weeks later is not really going to stop you from doing it. But I also think that there's a great number of fans out there who get it. There are people who honestly love comics, want to see comics continue, and are happy to put down their money to keep this industry going. You know, do I think piracy is, you know, the leading cause of why sales are spiraling downward? No, obviously not. There are a lot of factors. Piracy is one of them. It's, you know, if everybody stopped pirating tomorrow, would the industry be healthy all of a sudden? No, it wouldn't. We have a lot of other things to fix. However, from my standpoint, I come at it like, look, I've never downloaded anything in my life. Movie, music, comic, book, anything. Just because it would never occur to me to take something without paying for it. You know, if the creator of it, the artist, the musical artist, the writer, if they want to give it away, that's awesome. Everybody thinks that's great. But let the creator make that decision themselves. You know, I would like to make the decision of whether we want to give Shinku number one away for free or not. Not some dude in his basement with a scanner.
Right.
You know, and to me, that's where it gets even more, I mean, that's when it makes me even a little crazier, is because you end up dealing with, you know, most creator-owned books, you're not getting any money out of it up front.
Yeah.
So everybody that worked on Shinku number one did it for free. Everybody. Me, penciler, inker, colorist, letterer, our production guy and editor, everybody, everybody has yet to make a dime off of it. The fact that somebody made the decision that, hey, this is pretty cool, I'm going to give it away, you know, the fact that everybody busted their ass working on it, and some guy just gives it away and makes an endless number of copies, is really pretty offensive. That's what I can't quite wrap my head around, is that somebody who's interested enough in comics to go out and buy it, right? To go out and buy that issue, because you've got to have something to scan. And then to take the time to sit down and scan it and upload the whole damn thing. Somebody who is interested enough in comics and has enough time to do that doesn't grasp that they're actually harming the industry by doing that. It, you know, my brain doesn't work like that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really boggled my mind. Not just in general, but very specifically, you know, Rich Johnson watches these sites and then 4 minutes after the first ones go live says, hey, the entire New 52 bundle is up on XYZ torrent site. And I just sit there and go, like, who the hell goes out first thing when the shop opens, plunks down $40 plus, and then goes home and immediately says, you know what I'm going to do? It doesn't make any damn sense to me, and so it's a very weird
it's a very weird phenomenon for that reason, because you're right, like, this isn't just like some jerk in the back of the movie theater with a camera who you know, wants to take it home and watch it for himself. It's like, if you already have the physical product, I don't see even the incentive to scan it.
Yeah, I don't. It's like I said, my brain just doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, I guess that's why I'm so vocal about it, because to me it's, you know, it's not, oh, it's a gray area. It's, you know what? It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's black and white, and it's ultimately really simple. If it's not yours, don't give it away to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, you know. And, oh, you know, you two can afford to have me, you know, bootleg the album and upload it to torrent. Yeah, they probably can. But, you know, you're dealing with, you know, when you say that, you're dealing with the top 1% of 1% of all people that are trying to make a living off of making music.
Yeah.
When you say, oh, well, it's Marvel in D.C., they can afford to have somebody give away their product, and it's actually good for them because it generates readership. Well, really, that's not your decision to make.
That argument has so little merit to me. And there was a columnist, and I won't say who, but there was a columnist recently on one of the comic sites who, in the course of commenting on digital, said, and, you know, the only reason that I became a reader was because I went online and I downloaded every Batman the Animated Series comic ever made, which is, you know, like 400 or 500 comics. And I'm sitting here going, how do you make that leap? How do you decide, like, you know what? Even though I'm not interested, I'm going to go steal $1,000 worth of stuff all at once. Like, if you did that any other, you know what I mean? There's no other setting where that would be even remotely acceptable. And,
you know, I always liken it to somebody who, you know, who goes into a restaurant, orders one of everything on the menu, and then says, well, I like this one, that one, and the other one. I'm just going to pay you for those.
Right.
That's not the way life works, man. You know, and it's a moral issue, because it's right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's not yours, don't take it. It's very simple. But to me, it's also a maturity issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my kids, especially my oldest, who just turned 16, has friends who, you know, download movies and games,
mm-hmm.
and books and whatever else they want to get their hands on. And that's fine. You know, that's they're not, those kids aren't my kids. It's not my job to supervise them, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my kids understand that, hey, you know what? This is how, you know, we pay the mortgage every month.
Yeah.
This is how, you know, how we put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very early on, my kids kind of understood that was essentially taking money out of somebody's pocket. And that you don't have a right to do that just because you want it.
Right.
And like I said, if somebody wants to give it away, great. You know, my kid comes down from his room and says, look, hey, I got this game for free, or Coldplay put up an album for free, or, you know,
right.
That's great. You know, Nine Inch Nails, you know, posted an album for free. That stuff's awesome. That's also from people who aren't trying to make a living doing this. This is from people who aren't, you know, paying the monthly bills.
Yeah.
By their creative work, which is frankly the vast majority of people who make music or art or comics or books or whatever,
mm-hmm.
whatever you're talking about. You know, in my Shelf Life column on CBR today,
mm-hmm.
you know, I talked about, you know, what it's like to write and what, you know, what it's like to make ends meet doing this. And I, you know, I am completely aware that I am absolutely blessed to be able to be making a living for 20 years just making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also aware that the more people who take stuff for free and distribute it to whoever else wants it for free, the harder it gets all the time to
mm-hmm.
make a living.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me because when people, like when Dan Slott came out and blasted people who had admitted to downloading She-Hulk, or I think he went onto some torrent site and actually commented in the comments thread, like, all you people are stealing my work. I remember it being this huge, like, argument and this huge fight, and I'm just sitting here going, like, even the people who are rationalizing it with whatever way they're rationalizing it, I can't imagine that, like, when the guy comes in and says, hey, asshole, that, like, how do you rationalize it to that degree, to where, like, when the actual writer comes in and says, knock it off, that you sit there and argue with him, you know? Completely.
These are arguments that take place on the internet.
Yeah.
Not face-to-face, not at a convention somewhere, not at a signing. I mean, nobody comes up to you at a signing and says, I downloaded all your stuff for free and I don't care whether you get a penny off of it.
Right.
I have never had that conversation in person. because frankly, people are, people are a lot more polite and kinder in person than they would ever be on the web. And that's also just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I think, it's very easy to be, to be very negative about this and
yeah.
to be very offended by it because, frankly, every creator out there, Marvel book or DC book or especially a creator-owned book, is losing some money. And, look, obviously not everybody who downloads something is going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 10%, 5% might actually be a lost sale.
Right.
It's not by any means a majority that you can chalk up as a lost sale.
Right.
But the thing that I actually take some hope from is that when I've talked about this on the internet or I've been running my app on Twitter, I've had people tell me, oh, wow, I never actually thought of it that way, or that didn't occur to me.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what happens to a majority of people is, they just don't carry the argument through to the fact that it affects actual human beings.
Right.
If it's just a torrent that you're pulling off the web somewhere, it's much easier to think of it as not really having anything to do with an actual person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you make it personal and when you put a face on it, I think by and large most people are decent people.
Mm-hmm.
There's always gonna be a jackass who just feels like the world owes him whatever he wants. But I think by and large most people are good and want to do the right thing. But I think a lot of people don't even understand that the right thing is to go out and pay for it because they're just not completing the thought.
Right.
And so I've had people on Twitter that have told me, wow, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's, one or two people a month that kind of come to that conclusion, that's great. And I've actually had a couple people tell me that they've stopped downloading because of something I've said or something that some other pro has said.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually had one person say that they deleted all of the files that they downloaded and went out and bought everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because they felt guilty about having done that and wanted to make it right. And to me, if I run my app about it and a couple people stop, and people hear about them stopping, and everything starts with one person,
right?
And it's never gonna go away completely. But the fact that there are legal downloads available for just a huge amount of stuff now,
yeah,
DC stuff is available same day. Little by little, I think we, you know, we as an industry start to take back some of the ground we've lost because we just didn't have any sort of digital presence that was very expansive.
And now the last thing that I'll ask, just a more general question, but we've talked, the last couple of things we've talked about were all kind of DC stuff, and you know, you said the thing about you're not cheerleading for them just because you're writing a book, but that how open is Top Cow to everything that you're doing these days? Because I mean, you're not just doing Voodoo, but you also did the retroactive Green Lantern special, which I got to tell you, I really enjoyed. I don't know if you're aware of this, but not only did your Green Lantern retroactive special, which you know came out on the final week of the old DC universe, but also the Green Lantern issue that came out that week, both referenced the Batman Guy Gardner one punch moment.
Yeah, you know, I saw that the Green Lantern issue did it as well, and I just thought, you know, what a weird kind of coincidence, because I had no idea, and I'm sure
right.
they had no idea that we were doing that in the retro issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that...
And, of course, Keith and Mark had an issue come out that day, too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's that, you know, that moment is a touchstone for everybody that was kind of, that was there for it, that was
mm-hmm.
at that point. You know, in terms of how Top Cow is, they're, you know, you know, they're tremendous to work for. All those guys are my buddies, and I am forever grateful for everything that they let me do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship will certainly continue as long as, you know, as long as they want me. But, as, you know, they're cool with me doing, you know, doing things in other places as long as I'm not, you know, I'm not blowing my deadlines for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very generous and very forgiving when I snuck off to do a couple of Conan issues to pay for my son's trip to Europe over the summer or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to touch base on that because I know that, you know, depending on the company, depending on the circumstances, different exclusivity deals are more or less constrictive, but it seemed like you're doing more work for DC in the last 6 months than I'd seen from anybody except for, Top Cow in a while. And I just felt...
Yeah, it's, you know, things ebb and flow and, you know, and honestly, you know, like when the decision was made that I would step away from Witchblade to concentrate on other things,
mm-hmm.
you know, it really didn't have anything to do with Voodoo because the Voodoo offer hadn't even been made yet at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything's fairly fluid. You know, as a freelancer, you kind of have the responsibility to make sure you don't take on so much that you end up destroying the deadlines on all of the projects. You know, I've been doing this long enough to kind of know where that line is and hopefully not cross it very often.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the nature of being a freelancer is to maybe take on just a little bit more than you can handle because, you know, it's hard to say no, especially when it's a gig that you want to do.
All right, there was a lot more than that, but, you know, that's off the record. Thanks very much to Ron Mars for joining us again. It's always a pleasure to talk to Ron. It's always fun to see where the conversation goes. Thanks again to Fabian Nicieza, who, you know, brings a real enthusiasm to the table. I'm not a big Legion guy, but I'm looking forward to checking that series out. I'm looking forward to checking out Voodoo. We can talk about that next episode. The next episode we run will be our New York Comic Con episode. We're taking a little break, but when we come back, we're going to be coming back strong. We're going to have interviews with Bruce Timm, Andrea Romano, and Kevin Conroy about Batman Year One and Justice League Doom. We're going to be talking to Dan Jurgens, Eric Larson, Terry Moore, all the usual suspects about whatever exciting things they got going on at New York Comic Con. And, you know, we will be...
just kind of bouncing around the floor, so I'm sure there will be more people that we'll be talking to either next episode or in the next few. If you have any questions, anything that you want to request that I cover, shoot me a line. It's Russ Burlingame, RussBurlingame at comicbook.com. And I will talk to you all folks in a few weeks. Wow.